This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's time for our weekly review of state news. The former chancellor and vice chancellor at UW Oshkosh have been charged with felonies in the latest chapter of the story of financial mismanagement on that campus. After the record-setting blizzard that hit central and northeastern Wisconsin, farmers are being encouraged to file claims for damages sustained. And also in the news, Wisconsin's attorney general is encouraging schools to apply for school safety funding. And a notorious Wisconsin criminal who evaded capture for several months in 1987 has died. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks.
Let's start things off, Rob, at UW Oshkosh, this ongoing problem there. Now, former Chancellor Richard Wells and former Vice Chancellor Tom Sonlietner were charged in Winnebago County Circuit Court on Thursday. What are they accused of, Rob?
Right. So we have known for some time that there were some shady financial practices at the UW Oshkosh, because this had been the subject of findings by the UW system. There was the UW system had filed a civil lawsuit. But these are the first criminal charges. And I would say it was still, there's still an element of surprise when the felony charges came down this week against this former chancellor and vice chancellor. Essentially, at issue is that they are alleged to have moved money from the budget of the university to its foundation in order to bolster some building projects that they saw as priorities for the university. There's not really an allegation that they were like embezzling funds for themselves or enriching themselves, but it is a case where that there are laws that separate the budgets of the UWO itself, which includes, public taxpayer money, from the budget of the UWO Foundation, which is private. Private donations, and it appears, or prosecutors allege, that they did not respect those boundaries.
And UW Regents were on board with the idea of filing criminal charges here?
Right, yeah. I mean, the Regents had referred the matter to the Department of Justice in the first place. They have been pretty hard on the way that the funds were handled. The criminal complaint says that these two, the chancellor and vice chancellor, signed loan guarantees for a hotel project that was supposed to be financed by the foundation, but that that would have put UW Oshkosh itself on the hook for any, what they said in the letters, were any additional investment loans and expenses. So from the point of view of Regents, that was reckless use of UW Oshkosh funds.
Do we have an idea of a timeline now on these charges and when they go to court?
So they'll have their first appearance in June. I would not expect a resolution to this anytime soon. These sorts of cases tend to take a very long time. On the high end, they're facing 3.5 years in prison if found guilty.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin about some of the top stories in Wisconsin news this week. Rob, not that far removed from that big blizzard that hit your neck of the woods in northeastern Wisconsin, especially hard, lots of snow. And what kind of damage now did that record-setting snowfall cause?
Yeah, it's like a hazy memory now. But yeah, it was like only a couple of weeks ago there was 2 feet of snow coming down. Yeah, I mean, there were a number of cases, especially in the Green Bay area, which was hit with 2 feet of snow. It was like late April, so it was very wet, heavy snow. And there were a number of cases where roofs were caving in some local businesses there, and in this case, especially at a number of dairy farms. So there's a dairy farm in Kewaunee where a barn that had more than 1,000 cows just collapsed. There's been a lot of damage to a lot of different small businesses and farms.
And this is in the news this week. Governor Walker has been visiting some of the damaged farms and has been encouraging farmers to document and report the damage that was caused. What can they do then with that?
Right. So if they there's no sort of emergency declaration yet, but if they can document and report this damage, the It would go through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. If you're a dairy farmer, that's who you would report this to. And the USDA, the secretary, then can make a declaration and can get these farmers some help. Most likely, it would come in the form of like low interest loans that they could use to pay for repairs, just to take financial pressure off them as they try to recover.
We're taking a look at some of the top state news stories of the week with Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you still recovering from damage from that big snowstorm? And coming up, we'll talk about school safety. The state is offering grants to schools to boost their safety procedures and infrastructure. Is this something of concern to you and your district? If you work for a district, are you going to be applying for this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We're looking at some of the top news stories of the week with Rob Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, a school security funding available now. The state is issuing this, and the state's attorney general says, hey, schools, get out there and apply. Talk about these grants.
Sure. This is a pot of about $100 million of grants that are open to all schools in across the state that they can use for building upgrades or for staff training that promotes school security. This is a response of sorts to the school shooting in Florida, the Parkland shooting, and was signed into law just about a month ago, passed very quickly, and is now this week is open for applications.
And Attorney General Brad Schimmel is, as I said, encouraging schools to take advantage of the opportunity, but he cautioned that there's no such thing as a 100% secure school, said this about steps that would try to achieve that.
Not anything that we would want to stomach, because it would become like a National Guard armory building, and that we don't want our kids going to school.
So this is more modest measures than a complete 100% safety. What kind of things can school districts do with this grant money, Rob?
Well, so a notable part of this, about a third of the overall grant funding, will go toward the goal of making sure that all schools by this fall in Wisconsin are using a single secure entrance. So that's, you know, most schools have that. Not every single one does, so you'll have to buzz in or whatever. Other things the money might be used for would be like locks on classroom doors, shatterproof glass. You know, I mean, schools in Wisconsin, like schools in a lot of places, are often old buildings. And so these would be upgrades for security that probably was not even considered at the time that the buildings were built.
And Rob, I want to spend a few minutes on this last story. Stephen K. Thompson passed away this week. Not a household name now, but he was also known as Rambo. This was a huge story in the Wausau area, in Wisconsin in general, back in 1987. I'll say, Rob, when I moved back into Wisconsin in 1991, I met a bunch of people from Marathon County. They were still arguing about how police handled this. Tell us the story of Stephen K. Thompson.
Sure. I mean, it was absolutely a sensation, and it's something that everyone around here who was here at the time remembers vividly. So Stephen K. Thompson is from Michigan, and he was had gotten in some trouble as a young man and was in a prisoner in a work camp in the Upper Peninsula in Michigan, and he walked away, and he walked down through the UP into Wisconsin and made his way over the course of months by breaking into people's cabins, stealing food, and sometimes just sleeping in the woods. He was at a cabin outside of Wausau in July of 1987, when the owner of the cabin came home, and he had a gun. He shot out of a window. He was later was convicted of this. Shot out of a window. There was a standoff. Police responded. There was a emergency responders couldn't get in to get the homeowner who had been shot in the stomach, and then Thompson disappeared. And he was the subject of a massive manhunt across the state. Daily headlines, sort of where is the shooter? The man that was shot was in the hospital for 6 weeks. He ultimately recovered. But it was an unsettled time, and Thompson finally turned himself in Minnesota months later in October, having made his way on foot across the whole state.
So he finally turned himself in, pled guilty to the shooting, served 24 years in prison, paroled, got in trouble again, finally out of prison for good in 2014, another jail stay after that, though. You interviewed him, Rob, when he was released in 2014. Here's a clip from your interview with him.
During the 5 months I was on escape, I probably broke into between 75 and 100 cabins. And I avoided homes because I didn't want any contact with people. Like I said, I was paranoid. I was delusional thinking. Actually, it was the most boring time in my life. You're out there. There's nobody to talk to. You're always looking for airplanes or wondering if dogs are going to be after you. And I've had dogs after me. I tried to calculate how many times I've had dogs after me. And I think it's 11 times. 11 times tracking dogs have been used on me, and they've never caught me yet.
So I hear a little regret there, Rob, and a little pride, too, in evading capture. What was your take talking to this guy?
Right. It was one of the more... bizarre stories, I guess, that I've really reported, to be honest. The way it came about is he walked into the office one day and said he wanted to talk with someone and had a story to tell. And I talked with him over the course of several weeks for a long story that I wrote back in 2014. And he was, you put your finger on something. Like, he had grievances. He had things that he was still angry about his treatment. He maintained his innocence. Though he had pled guilty, he always said that he was innocent of the crimes he was convicted for. But there was also an element for sure where he wanted to relive this manhunt. It was the most accomplished thing that he did in his life. I mean, that's the way that he looked at it. He had outsmarted all these police over the course of all this time, and those were glory days in some sense for him.
We leave it there for now. Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That's Rob Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, rounding up some of the top stories in Wisconsin news from the past week. On average, smoking rates in Native American communities are higher than the population as a whole, a fact that's not lost on tribal leaders. In order to curb those numbers, some in Wisconsin and Minnesota are looking to their own history. The hope is that by restoring a reverence for the spiritual and ceremonial importance of tobacco, commercial cigarette use will go down. Dina Fine-Marin is the health and medicine editor for Scientific American. Her recent piece is called The Fight to Keep Tobacco Sacred. Dina, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Let's start with what Native American groups are dealing with when it comes to rates of smoking. Can you talk about what we're seeing in that population versus the country as a whole?
Absolutely. So smokers make up only about 16% of the overall U.S. adult population. That's 1/6. But it's double the number among Native American communities in the United States. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say about 32% of Native American adults nationwide are smokers. It's a really scary number. And, of course, that can vary state to state. Minnesota, for example, only about 15% of the overall adult population smokes, but the rate jumps to nearly 60% among tribal members.
And this is a huge question with a couple hundred years of history behind it, but what are the ideas about why smoking rates are so high among Native Americans?
Yeah, so it's obviously a complex question. Part of it is the same as any community in a sense that a person may light up in response to many reasons, social pressures to relieve stress and so forth. But one of the driving factors among this community is that tobacco actually had a very rich history among different Native American communities in the United States where they used it for a variety of traditional ceremonies, often not smoking them, in fact, but laying them on the ground for traditional rituals and so forth. But in the United States, until the passage of the Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1978, laws actually banned many Native American cultural practices, including various traditional uses of tobacco. And as a result, many Native American communities tried to find ways to still secretly use tobacco in their rituals, and those included substituting in cigarettes in ways that they wouldn't be detected. So, for example, at a funeral, it used to be traditional in one community I visited in Minnesota that they would take ritually grown tobacco and place it on the ground to offer prayers to the spirit world for the deceased. But since they were no longer allowed to do that, they would instead bring cigarettes, pass them around, and smoke them at the same time as a way to try to keep that prayer tradition alive.
And that brings us to the main part of your piece. You visited with Native American groups, leaders, individuals in Wisconsin, Minnesota, I think North Dakota, and there's an effort to stop the addiction to modern cigarettes by turning back to those older historical tobacco traditions. Can you talk about that?
Exactly so. Yeah, there's a concerted effort among several tribes in the United States to try to go beyond traditional smoking cessation messages like don't smoke, tobacco is bad, and so forth, to incorporate more of a culturally sensitive message, in part because these communities wouldn't necessarily think tobacco is inherently bad, the product they've had a relationship with, the plant, from a long time before big tobacco. So they are trying to grow traditional tobacco on site and in some reservations or in people's backyards, and combine that with efforts to try to teach about traditional cultural uses. So that might mean in the school setting and community centers, and trying to bring more traditional tobacco to community gatherings rather than bring cigarettes. And that, of course, they're trying to couple with other ways to try to combat high smoking rates, including no smoking legislation and enforcement, better access to smoking cessation services, and looking at maybe making some of their casinos smoke-free and increasing cost of cigarettes. So more mainstream messaging and intervention efforts to be combined with these culturally focused ones.
We're talking to Dina Fine-Marin. She's the health and medicine editor for Scientific American. We're looking at smoking and tobacco among Native American tribes, especially in the upper Midwest. And Dina, let's meet some of the people now that you talked to, including someone in Wisconsin who is growing this this kind of different style of tobacco. Can you talk about him?
Sure. So one person I spoke with who's a member of the Ho-Chunk community in Wisconsin, his name is David Greendeer, and he was a former legislator in his tribal community. And he grows tobacco in his backyard, but he says that though he grows 150 plants every year for his personal family's use, once you process that and dry it, that only shakes out to about four coffee cans of tobacco to last the entire year. And so that will be used in his community for religious purposes and amongst his family. But he says if everyone moved to something like that where you're growing tobacco yourself, it would be difficult to sustain the type of practices where you would smoke many times a day with it because, frankly, you wouldn't have enough of the tobacco.
Can you talk about some of the traditional uses his small crop of tobacco might be put to?
Sure. So the traditional practices differ community to community, and some individuals were shy about or sharing that kind of information with an outsider like me. But more generally, I read up and talked to some people about some traditional methods. For example, some tribes place tobacco on the ground or burn it in a dish or shell, and that smoke is believed to carry prayers to the creator. Dried tobacco might be sprinkled on or near a car to ensure a safe journey. If you were dealing with making a deal for with something like a contract, presenting a gift of tobacco when a deal or contract is forged is believed to make the agreement more binding in some communities. And, of course, tobacco is widely believed to also be employed medicinally. So let's say a family member is sick, you might bring some dry tobacco and sprinkle it on the bed, and that's thought to protect the patient and serve as a healing agent.
And tobacco, we're talking about it, actually, you write, is a different, the plant is very different from what might be grown to end up in a commercial cigarette.
Exactly. So there are two different species we're talking about here. In the United States, among Native American communities, there's a rich history of growing one particular species called Nicotiana rustica, and that's a short and spindly-looking tobacco plant. It's also got, interestingly enough, much more nicotine than the plant that's used by big tobacco that's called Nicotiana tobacum. And as a result, if you're smoking the traditional tobacco plant, that makes the indigenous plant smoke really hard to inhale. So for that reason, and because Nicotiana tobacum produces much more tobacco per plant, big tobacco companies have moved forward with that latter species instead for mass production. But also the plant that is used by big tobacco does not really bear a strong resemblance to Nicotiana tobacum that was originally grown either, and that's because, like every commercial crop, it's been significantly altered. It bears little resemblance to its ancestors because it's been enhanced for certain traits, for flavor or growth.
You also write that part of what might be in tobacco is not tobacco at all. Other plants might fit that category.
Yeah. What some Native American communities call traditional tobacco, in quotes, might not actually be the tobacco plant itself. It might be a mix of other plants that have also been called that. Particular kinds of willow trees and bearberries were used as well. But for the communities that I spoke with in this article, they did refer specifically to an actual tobacco plant that they were growing. But the term is still used more broadly to refer to these other plants as well.
In Minnesota, you met with leaders in the White Earth Nation, and they're really making an effort to make tobacco a sacred product again. Can you talk about what kind of efforts they're doing there?
Yeah, so in that community in Minnesota, they have a reservation, and on that reservation, about 8 years ago, they started planting seeds for Nicotiana rustica, this more traditional plant. They actually got the seeds from another community, another tribe in New York that kindly gave them the seeds when they asked for it, and so they've been growing them in the community, trying to teach people about traditional use, and that's also gone beyond beyond just the woman who's leading this effort. Her name is Gina Boudreau, and she works on smoking cessation and smoking prevention practices. There's a traditional school in the reservation where cultural practices are incorporated, and one of the practices they're looking at is they've been growing tobacco on site on the campus and teaching the kids about what tobacco has meant to their community and how to use it.
And Dina, this is part of an effort, this idea of sacred tobacco. As you mentioned, it goes along with other smoking cessation efforts. Are there any signs that the needle is moving, that smoking rates are going down?
There are some early indications that smoking rates are going down in both the Ho-Chunk community in Wisconsin and the White Earth community in Minnesota that I spoke to, but unfortunately that data does remain pretty anecdotal. Part of the question here is that tribal governments are often the ones that are collecting their own health data as opposed to, let's say, the United States federal government coming in and collecting that kind of information. So this all depends on what the community has chosen to gather data about, what they're willing to share, and whether or not they're capturing large slices of the community. A lot of the data I got on the Ho-Chunk community in Wisconsin came from surveys that they had done of their sizable diabetic populations. That wouldn't necessarily capture everybody. But so far, it does look like they might be moving slightly. And whether or not that is truly because of this traditional tobacco intervention or is, you know, taking place in the larger context of interventions that are happening more broadly and greater awareness about cancer and various smoking-related illnesses, well, that's kind of hard to tease apart.
We'll leave it there for now. Dina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dina Fine-Marin is the health and medicine editor for Scientific American. She was with us to talk about how some Native American tribes are looking to lower smoking rates by keeping alive the ceremonial use of traditional tobacco.